Welcome, everyone, to Investing for Generational Wealth. Let us dive in to the expert world of expert financial insights and strategies. Before we begin, a quick disclaimer: we're not financial advisors. All investments are subject to risks, including the possible loss of the money you invest. So perform your due diligence before making any financial decisions. And of course, consult your experts, your CPAs, financial advisors, lawyers, etc. We're just two guys who like to dress up a little on Wednesdays and host podcasts. That's it. So don't take advice from us. I'm your host, Keshav Kalor, and I'm joined by my co-host, John Lai. And welcome to today's episode, Net Lease Commercial Real Estate Investments. And today's guest is Dan Lukowitz. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
That was perfect. I don't know if that's ever happened before.
It's okay. From one difficult team name to another, I understand the struggles. Thank you for being on with us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. And if you could kick us off, just give us a brief introduction about your experience, your history, and where you are today.
Yeah. So I'm Dan Lukowitz. I am a senior director at Encore Real Estate Investment Services. I'm a net lease investment sales broker, which means that I help buyers and sellers transact in net lease properties nationwide. I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about what those are, what that means. I've been in, you know, the real estate space now, gosh, it's been almost 20 years. Started off, you know, as residential, mostly in you know, house hacking and then house flipping and, you know, just a lot of investment activities on the residential side. Eventually transitioned into commercial real estate brokerage and investments. And, you know, I love what I do. I love my, you know, my day to day, and you have a lot of opportunity to help people and help generate a lot of, you know, tremendous wealth for my clients, and really feel fortunate to be where I'm at.
Great. And so could you dive in a little more into what you're doing currently, what kind of assets you're helping transact on, what your specialties are within commercial real estate?
So really two main buckets. The first would be single tenant net lease assets. So these would be properties like, you know, Walgreens or CVS or Dollar General, Taco Bell, Wendy's. These would be, you know, medical office buildings. So those would be a single tenant in one building on a net lease, which means in general that the tenant is paying for all of the expenses. The landlord is completely hands-off and passive. There are some exceptions to that that we can go into later. That would be one bucket. The other bucket would be shopping centers, so multi-tenant retail properties. Anywhere from, you know, I'm doing a deal right now, it's only, you know, 5,000 square feet up to 200,000 or 300,000 square feet. So these could be shopping centers with 3, 4, 5 tenants, 10 tenants, 20, 30, 40 tenants, really a lot of variety there. You know, not as passive as the single tenant net lease properties I referenced a moment ago. A lot of different types of opportunity to maximize the asset's value through capital expenditure and, you know, through conversion of leases from gross leases to triple net leases. In terms of, you know, bringing rents up to market, increasing occupancy, lowering the cap rate, et cetera, a great opportunity there for tremendous, you know, equity buildup.
Gotcha. Okay. And how did you make that transition from single family into, like, just walk us through your journey a little bit more?
Yeah. So, I mean, I started getting really involved in single family home flipping during the last recession. And, you know, when we had, as an investor, it was a great time, you know, opportunities to buy properties for pennies on the dollar, renovate them and resell them. I did a lot of that, which was great, especially when I was younger, had maybe a little more energy, a little more patience. But, you know, that's a very difficult business to scale and a very difficult business to run, just in terms of your, you know, responsibilities of raising capital, putting your own capital up, you know, securing your properties, making sure that everything goes well with the renovation and with the sale. So, you know, I did that for a long time. Most of the time I did that, I also had, you know, a regular job. I ran a sales department for a title insurance agency. I was I did resource development for a large private school. I eventually got involved working at Amazon as a business development executive, all the while continuing to flip houses on the side. When I left Amazon, I went full-time into house flipping for a few years, which was a good experience, but it was a difficult one. And then in terms of the actual transition point, I mean, I had, you know, I was approached by a net lease investment sales brokerage that was looking to hire top sales execs from other fields and put them in a brokerage role. I started doing research about net lease. I was always fascinated about the concept of, for example, Amazon having a fulfillment center that they sign a lease on that all of a sudden is turned into gold. I like that idea of having national credit tenants signing leases and adding tremendous value to properties. So I said, you know what, I need to phase out of you know, house flipping. It's just not, there's too much risk involved. And I recognize that, you know, a typical average commission in a commercial real estate brokerage perspective or position capacity, if you will, was probably better than my best house flips. So I could do all that, you know, sitting in the comfort of my office, you know, with limited risk and a great opportunity for, you know, development and growth and the ability to scale my business.
I didn't know you were former Amazon.
Yeah.
We have a lot of those on the call. So I worked at Amazon as well in 2021. John is still there and he's been there like 5 to 10 years. I forget how long.
7 years. Yeah, that's right.
Seven years.
No kidding.
Yeah, no. Exactly. We have a lot of people on our call are also from Amazon. So
very nice.
Yeah. And you're in good company.
That's right.
Hey, Dan, as a point of clarification for definition, net lease versus triple net lease, are they equivalents?
So great question. And I just dealt with this today with a client, but net lease would be the broad field that would include single tenant net lease and shopping centers. Now, there's a little bit of a discrepancy because in some parts of the country, they call a triple net lease what I would call a double net lease. So I guess now's a good time to make just an overall simplistic, you know, definition of the different types of net lease. So if we go, I call it actually an absolute triple net lease. So that's the type of deal where the first end, the taxes and insurance on your property are paid by the tenant. The second end, the common area maintenance paid by the tenant. And the third end, the you know, roof, structure, parking, all of that paid by the tenant. So in an absolute triple net lease deal, the landlord has zero responsibilities, zero expenses. The rent is the bottom line, okay? So that's absolute triple net. Now, the next category would be what I call double net. And double net would be exactly the same, taxes, insurance, common area maintenance, all paid by the tenant. However, roof and structure, that's paid by the landlord. And in some cases, depending on the lease, the parking lot may be paid for by the landlord as well. So I call that double net. Again, in some areas, people would call that triple net. That's why, to avoid ambiguity, I go absolute triple net, everything paid by the tenant, double net, roof structure, and maybe parking paid for by the tenant.
That's good. Okay. Thank you for the clarification.
I'm sorry. Roof structure and maybe parking paid for by the landlord. My mistake. Misspoke. Yes.
Okay.
What does it look like when you're making, you know, trying to get tenants in there, like whether you go, you know, single net, double or triple net, what does that decision process look like?
So, you know, primarily I'm an investment sales broker, which means that I'm the one that's selling the buildings that already have the leases in place. I do have listings where I have properties listed for lease right now. It's all going to be based on the negotiation of the landlord and the tenant. In fact, you can have the same exact tenant, for example, CVS, that in some cases they sign an absolute triple net lease, no landlord responsibilities. In some cases they sign a double net lease where roof structure, maybe even parking are going to be a landlord responsibility. So it's 100% up to the negotiation. There are certain tenants that just don't sign, like their leases are always double net. Dollars, a lot of dollar stores, for example, always double net and typically flat, no rental increases during the base term. However, some dollar stores like Dollar General, they just started rolling out this year their new, you know, some of their newest developments do have rental bumps. So, you know, they make changes from time to time. But, you know, in general, there's standardization for certain tenants, but it is all subject to negotiation.
So when you, what I heard was you are a broker for the buildings. People who are either leasing or selling the buildings get into or request your services for negotiating the lease terms?
It definitely happens. So, like, you know, I'll give an example. I was working with a client who had a Burger King with 2 years left on the lease, and rather than list it, he asked me to reach out to the tenant and negotiate a lease. So yes, they definitely will, you know, request my assistant there. I have a CVS for sale and lease here in Michigan. But, you know, the owner reached out and said, "Dan, I want to only lease this property." So I listed it for lease. We got a ton of interest for sale, no interest for lease. So he said, "Dan, okay, let's list it for sale as well." So there's some carryover, but I mean, if I'm dealing with a property in like a tertiary market and the seller wants me to lease it for them, I'm probably going to bring in a partner of mine that's an expert in that market who can provide, you know, even more attention and services than I could.
Got it. Okay. Thanks.
From, I guess, like in the ideal scenario, whoever's the landlord, like whoever's leasing it out, is their ideal scenario always just to go triple net? And then it's just how well they can negotiate with the tenant.
Yeah, I mean, a triple net lease is going to be landlord favorable. Keep in mind, like, so we can talk about this on the single tenant realm and on the shopping center realm. If you're in the single tenant realm and it's absolute triple net lease, you don't have to worry about any expenses, and you don't have to worry about managing those expenses and arranging for them to be had. And furthermore, you don't have to worry about any type of fluctuation in expenses. I mean, I'm underwriting deals all day long. It's not uncommon right now. You know, if gasoline prices go up and the price of salt goes up, you might see 100% increase in your expense for parking lot plowing, right? And salting. So with absolute triple net, you don't care. It doesn't matter. And again, the same thing applies in shopping centers. There are a lot of shopping centers that are still on gross leases, which means that the tenant pays their rent. That's a gross number, and the landlord is responsible for all expenses. I highly recommend to all of my clients, when the lease rolls over, when it expires, to convert it to a triple net lease, because not only will it help your bottom line, but you're not going to have this variability of expenses that kills operators, right? So for a lot of reasons, yeah, having you know, absolute triple net leases is very important, and it's down to having, you know, sophisticated and educated negotiation skills.
Do you find that in this environment, that's not very favorable to commercial leases, standard, just I guess standard office leases, that triple leases, or the leases that you deal with, or even just I guess the sales of buildings, is that affected at all, or is that really not really affected?
So specifically, what do you mean? Are you asking, like, has the commercial net lease investment sales market been affected by the changing interest rate environment? Is that what you're trying to ascertain?
Changing interest rate, what happened to COVID as well, you know, coming out of COVID, all of that really.
Yeah. I mean, listen, COVID was 4 months of nobody knowing what was going on and people
Right.
pulling their hair out and running around and leaving the business. And then just like absolute insanity in terms of prices going up. And just deal flow. I mean, during COVID, we did an incredible number of deals. So, I mean, COVID was actually very good for, and ironically, for the commercial real estate, you know, industry, especially the brokerage industry. Now, this whole last 18, 24 months of interest rate changes, I mean, listen, if there's one single lever that can be pulled to have the largest effect possible on the commercial real estate space, it's without question the change in interest rates. And this 550 roughly basis point swing in the federal funds rate that we saw from, you know, essentially March of 2022 to till now, right? And now it's just been pausing, so it's even a shorter amount of time, right? That swing is a greater swing than we have seen in 40 years. You know, it was unprecedented in terms of how fast and how drastic it was. And, you know, I would have thought that commercial real estate would have come to a screeching halt. It didn't. It's still strong. It's stunted. And I believe that as interest rates change, which they inevitably will, and they go down, that's going to add a lot of fuel on this fire, and all this pent-up demand is going to have an escape valve. So, you know, it certainly has had an impact. I mean, a tangible impact. You look at assets like dollar stores, which had a lot of cap rate compression over the last 10 years. 10 years ago, a dollar store would trade at a close to a 10 cap. Then they went down to 9 caps, 8 caps, you know, 17, 18, 19, they were at like a 6 cap. 2021, they were down to like a 5.25 cap. A lot of compression on the cap rate, right? Which developers love, right? Everybody loves that. Maybe not buyers, but so that happens. And then with his interest rate changes, you know, an average 15-year dollar general, let's say, that was trading at a 5.25 cap has gone up to 6.75, maybe even 7%. So let's call it 6.75. That's a huge swing. It's nowhere near a proportional swing to how high interest rates have gone, right? 550 basis points, not 150 basis points. However, if you look at assets like quick service restaurants, one of my favorites, one of my specialties, fast food, right? Those cap rates have swung maybe 50 basis points. A deal at 5.25 today is at 5.75. Not a lot of swing. Shopping centers, they've seen a little bit of swing. But the thing with shopping centers is that they were always trading at a cap rate that was far enough above average debt rates that they made sense. Because that's really, if you look at one variable that moves the commercial real estate market, and again, it works in concert with interest rates, that's the delta between cap rates and interest rates. So if you have a negative delta, right, between cap rates and interest rates, then that's a problem, right? You can't really finance them. So a Chick-fil-A at a 4.5 cap doesn't make sense if you're borrowing at a 7 cap, right? It's a cash deal. But a shopping center that's at an 8 cap or a 9 cap, it makes sense to borrow at a 7 cap. So there's definitely been, you know, I would say like a negative impact on some of the single tenant deals and a positive impact on shopping centers because people have migrated from single tenant to shopping centers. People have migrated from multifamily to shopping centers. So it's interesting really to see how that's played out.
Got it. Do you see a lot of people just waiting on the sidelines then to see what the Fed will do?
Definitely. Whenever there's transition, people wait on the sidelines. That's just what they do. I think that a lot of sophisticated investors are not doing that. They're opportunistic. A lot of the big REITs I work, real estate investment trusts I work with, you know, are deploying capital left and right, just trying to buy more and more and more. A lot of people are seeing opportunity in so many different sectors right now. There really is a lot of opportunity. People are on the sidelines. You know, I think it's generally a mistake because, you know, you can just shift your strategy and still make money. But, you know, I think that it's an interesting time, and the run-up between now and November is going to be interesting because, you know, I think that invariably in any administration, this is not to get political, only to the extent that politics ties into business and commercial real estate, but in any administration, the goal at the end, especially of the first term, is to do what? Is to wave your flag, your victory flag, and show what you did. Jerome Powell wants to wave his inflation victory flag, right? Joe Biden wants to wave his economy victory flag. And you know what? The way that they're going to do that is by lowering interest rates. So I'll let them wave their flag. I don't care, right? Because I'm waiting for that. I want that. But I believe that the end of this year, it's going to be interesting to see what the Fed does. I think that they have no choice but to lower interest rates.
And Dan, you said that you're a sales broker for net leases. Do you invest into any syndication deals for net leases or like, you know, those?
I do.
Okay.
I do. And, you know, it's something I'm passionate about and excited about. I love investing. I've invested a lot in single family, as we talked to, right? I invested a lot in the stock market. And, you know, I personally don't, the stock market gives me way more heartburn than real estate, because at least in real estate, I understand it. You know, I might even be an expert in certain aspects, so I can control my risk by increasing my knowledge, which I really can't do. I don't have the time to do, you know, in the equities stock market, so to speak. However, one thing that I've done, which gave me tremendous pleasure, was so I'm self-employed as a commercial real estate broker. I have what's called a SEP IRA, right? Which is essentially a self-employed IRA. The limits are very high. It's awesome. Contribution limits, I should say. I don't pay taxes on any gains. It's all deferred until the end. So what I do is I invest specifically in my SEP IRA into joint ventures and syndications. One that I'm involved in right now, I'm very excited about. The operator, so to speak, is a close dear friend of mine who reached out to me, wanted my opinion on the deal before I even knew that he was going to be offering it. And, you know, I was involved in a similar investment at the time. So it's actually a joint venture loan we have lent money to an individual who is doing a build to suit with Starbucks. So we lent on his office building. It's secured by his office building and the surrounding parcel. Now, what's he doing to that parcel? He's putting one of the best tenants in the world in it. So all that's doing is increasing our security, which is really incredible. And one of the nice caveats too of the loan is that it's at a fixed interest rate. However, he is incentivized to pay us off sooner than later so that he can refi into a permanent loan. Our joint venture states that we get paid the same percentage whether he has our money for a month or a year. So it kind of, the way it's structured to me, I love it because the borrower is incentivized essentially to pay us more money.
Interesting.
So that, you know, that's an example. That's an example. And then, you know, that deal is going to be over here in the next couple of weeks. And, you know, I'll gladly reinvest that money into another, deal with syndication, joint venture, et cetera.
Do you have a buy box? Well, sorry. Do you have a buy box knowing what you know in net leases? And
I mean, so first of all, like, I'm not a big time net lease investor, and I try to really avoid a conflict of interest. You know, I don't want to be a broker who's buying my clients' deals. I just don't think that that's in their best interest, right? So I'm going to invest in like more of a joint venture or, you know, a private money loan, something like that, that has no conflict of interest. Can I tell you exactly what my buybacks would be if I had hundreds of millions of dollars and wanted to deploy it in net lease? Absolutely. I mean, I believe in certain fundamentals of certain assets. I mean, I love shopping centers, if you can't tell. I think that they provide great entrance cash flow relative to other net lease investments. And they have the opportunity for forced appreciation. I mean, if you're looking at the value of a commercial property, there's only two metrics that matter, right? There's cap rate and there's net operating income. Well, with a shopping center, you can influence both of those. You can lower the cap rate by increasing the type of, you know, by bettering the tenant, by deploying some capital expenditures and beautifying the property. You can increase the NOI by evicting bad tenants, by converting tenants from gross leases to net leases, which, by the way, also reduces the cap rate because that's what investors want, right? You can bring rents up to market rent, and you can build up property equity in a property, you know, very quickly. I love that. I think that's excellent. It's more active, right, than some of like the single tenant stuff. On single tenant side, I think fast food is great for the long game. As long as you have a long-term lease, you have good underlying fundamentals of the real estate, like the traffic counts, the population density. You need to have a very strong guarantor. People don't realize this. You look at one Wendy's driving down the highway, go 3 miles, look at another, they might be completely different because most of these leases are not corporate leases. They're guaranteed by a franchisee. I want a franchisee that has 200 units, not 2 units, right? That's important. So there's all kinds of things that you have to look for when you're saying like, yeah, this is my buy box. This is what I'm looking for, right? I also love the vacant property redevelopment space. And I think that's, you know, I tell people that, you know, house flipping is like a gateway drug, right? To get you into real estate, but it is a drug. Like for me, I see a vacant commercial property and I'm like, oh, what can I do to flip that and make it better? So yeah, I think there's opportunities all over. There's a few other strategies we can go into if you want for massive appreciation that don't involve swinging a single hammer, that I think is kind of cool. But you know, there are very specific criteria that I focus on when it's my own investment, and very specific criteria I focus on when I'm helping my investors to succeed in what they do.
Cool. Quick question here on the side. Someone's asking what a cap rate is. So for those of you who don't know, cap rate is basically involved in, it's a market variable. Each market and each asset class has a cap rate that it trades at. And so a cap rate is basically the NOI that a property brings in, an asset brings in, net operating income. So the revenue minus the expenses, not including the debt service, divided by what most reasonable people would pay for in that market. Let's say you had, in our case, a shopping mall that brought in $10 million a year in net operating income, and someone was willing to pay I guess based on the numbers you were saying, Dan, let's say someone was willing to pay like, what, 80 million? Maybe that sounds about right.
No, so, I mean, if you want to use round numbers, just say that they're willing to pay a 10 cap and it's worth $100 million.
Yeah. Let's just say hypothetically someone was willing to pay $100 million for that shopping mall that brought in $10 million and not net operating income. So $10 million of net operating income divided by $100 million of value means that traded at a 10% cap rate. So NOI divided by the property value gives you your cap rate. And again, that's a function of what market you're in, like geographically, as well as the asset itself. So Houston has a different cap rate for apartments versus shopping centers versus self-storage, et cetera.
There you go. Exactly. Yeah. Well said. So appreciate somebody, asking that question. I apologize that, I didn't take the time to define it.
No, you're good. You're good. And so, John and I, at least, and probably most people are really familiar with multifamily. What are your views on investing in retail versus multifamily in general, and especially now also?
Listen, I've never invested in multifamily. I've never brokered multifamily. I understand it. I've underwritten it. I've looked at a lot of deals. I mean, one of the things I don't like is like if you look at one of my packages, one of my offering memorandums that talks about a deal that I'm working on, it's going to tell you this is the net operating income. It's going to be, this is the rent. This is the, these are the expenses. This is the net operating income. Very transparent. Why? Because there are leases that spell out every single nuance of the agreement between the tenant and the landlord or the tenants and the landlord. So there's no such thing as a pro forma or, like a forward-looking analysis based on assumptions. We don't do that. I don't believe in that. Now, flip over to multifamily. I mean, what's not written on pro forma, right? Oh, well, listen, I understand right now if you buy this property, it's a four cap, a 4% return. But look at the pro forma, and we're going to raise rents 62% next year, right? And we're going to keep all of our tenants, and now it's going to be a 10 cap. I mean, I can pull strings too, right? I can pull levers. I can make numbers change and, just change a few numbers in a spreadsheet and everything looks good. I don't believe in that fuzzy math. So I'm not saying all multifamily is that, but I think that a lot is, and it's subject to that. So that really turns me off. I also believe that there was a huge number of multifamily syndicators that got into the space during the heyday, during these boom times, and didn't really know what they were doing. And they pulled those strings and changed those pro forma numbers and made things look better than they are. And I think that there's a lot of risk now because you have these destabilized assets with a lot of investor capital tied up. You have to be very careful. I mean, there are big time names that are all over the news right now who have 40, 50, $60 million loans foreclosing on them. What's going to happen to their investors? So, like, I just don't like that level of uncertainty. To me, again, like I talked about, I don't like the equities market. I don't like the stock market because there's so many unknowns, so many things can change. I can wake up, look at my phone in the morning, and lose 20% of the value of my portfolio. It happens, right? So I like net lease because it's very clear cut. I know what to expect. I think the cap rates in multifamily have compressed so far that, like I said to myself, if I can buy a multifamily at a five cap and I can buy a Wendy's at a five cap, why would I buy the multifamily? Why would I have to deal with changing expenses? Why would I have to deal with, potential vacancies, eviction moratoriums, all these different things when I can have this relatively guaranteed income stream with, 100% passivity? So to me, I'm not a fan. It doesn't mean it's wrong for everybody. It's just I see other things that make more sense to me.
To that end, we have a lot of maybe somewhat sophisticated, others are not as sophisticated, certainly as it relates to net leases. What would you say for someone that is interested in investing? How do you get started in investing versus being a buyer, right? As a single investor, how would you get involved?
Are you saying as a single investor, how do you get involved? Or you said, it sounded like you said,
As a
versus.
single investor, that's right.
As part of a
Okay.
syndication, I guess.
So that's what I'm clarifying. Are you asking how do you invest in a syndication or how do you invest and buy a building?
Syndication primarily, or a joint venture, whatever it might be, not so much buying a building.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, so I mean, like at that point, and from my perspective, it's like, I mean, look at the deal I told you guys about. This is a longtime friend. We've done deals together. I trust him. He's very intelligent. I believe that he's going to do the right thing, and he's concerned about his reputation. If he isn't any of those things, I'm risking my retirement. I don't want to do that. So first and foremost, if you're investing in a joint venture, a syndication, something where you're not going to be the operator, it's all about the relationship and the trust. I've looked at a ton of deals and talked to a ton of operators, and ultimately I ended up investing with a group that I know, because I feel like that eliminates some of the unknown or the potential or perceived risk even. So I think that that's first and foremost. After you vet the operator and feel comfortable with the operator, obviously it's important to know the deal as well. This Starbucks development deal I told you about, I knew the deal. In fact, the operator came to me to ask me for my expertise because I was in the middle of a Starbucks deal at that time. So that's going to be very important. Now, as a newer investor, you probably don't have those skills yet. You don't know what a good deal is, and that's okay. And there's only one way to find out what a good deal is. I had a conversation with an individual reached out to me. We had a call this morning. He met me on LinkedIn. He's a general manager of a NFL team. And we were talking the same exact question you just asked me. And I told him, I said, you got to get the repetitions in. I said, if I went to a game and I tried to scout NFL players with you on my first time, I wouldn't know anything. Like, I would choose the worst players, right? Yeah, I'd be worthless. But if I went with him to 100 games and scouted 100 times, I would start to pick things up and learn. It's no different with commercial real estate investing. You need to look at hundreds of deals. Do not invest in a deal until you've looked at hundreds of deals. You will see it's a muscle memory thing. You look at hundreds of deals, you're gonna pick up little nuances. Another analogy I give is like I bought another home, like I moved, my family, we moved 2.5 years ago. And we started looking at houses, and they were in much nicer neighborhoods, right? First house I saw, I was like, man, I love this house. Like, give me the contract. I'm ready to sign. I love everything about it. And then I said to myself, hold on, let me go look at another house. I looked at another house. I'm like, oh, this house has an attached garage. I want this house. And I'm like, you know what? Let me go to another house. Oh, this house has, I don't know, concrete driveway, whatever it is. The more houses I looked at, the more I refined what I wanted, and the more I was able to know what a good deal is. You look at 100 properties, you're going to refine what you want, and you're going to refine your ability to define a good deal. You're going to be able in 15 seconds to know, is this a deal I want to look into further, or is it a deal I want to throw in the garbage can?
Got it. Okay, that's good.
What are some big reasons that you would throw a deal in the garbage can when it comes to net leases?
Pro forma, like if I see, now I wouldn't throw it in the garbage can, but like you do see some brokers, and I want to smack them, who like have a multi-tenant shopping center. I'm getting all excited about it, and they have a pro forma page. I take it out. Like, I'm not looking at that. I don't care about that. Like, I'm not gonna let you try to sell my client on the upside that he's gonna work for. That doesn't make sense. That's not your, if I'm buying a distressed property and someone's like, well, when you fix it up, it's worth this. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. That's irrelevant to our discussion because I'm the one fixing it up. So that's a red flag to me when I see a pro forma. Obviously cap rates, I know cap rates pretty well. So if I see a deal that the cap rate is way too low, that tells me something. Grant might still tell my client to offer because it's just an asking cap, right? And you'd be surprised how much movement people have, especially when they're not selling their property. What else? I mean, here's a big one. Like, if the guarantor on the lease has bad financials, or there's not a lot of units behind the guarantee, or there's a personal guarantee from a high net worth individual that burns off, meaning it disappears very quickly. Another thing is a lot of net lease properties, you're going to have access to sales, especially in the quick service restaurant category. So if this is an interesting fact, there's a threshold that's pretty definite of what's called a rent to sales ratio, which is simply the rent to sales, right? It's a measure of the feasibility of the tenant to stay at the property long term, right? If their rent to sales is very low, that means they're making a lot of money and they're not spending a ton in rent. their rent to sales is very high, they're not making that much money, they're spending a lot in rent, they might not be there very long. So typically I look at a rent to sales ratio, 8% and below is good. Above 8%, like 8, 8.25, 8.5 starts to get sketchy. You'd be surprised. 9% or higher, that store is very, very high likelihood of closing. So that's important. Like, obviously I'd rather get my client or myself, if I'm investing in a joint venture or something, into a 6% rent sale than an 8% rent to sales deal. But that's very important. As are the sales in general. You know, there is also an economy of scale in the fast food restaurant industry. So if they're doing $2 million in sales, that's pretty good. Let's say they're only paying $60,000 in rent, but they're doing $1 million in sales. Okay, it's a 6% rent sale. Sounds good. However, there's certain fixed costs that are going to be there, whether they're doing $1 million or $2 million. So I want to make sure not only am I in that rent to sales ratio that's healthy, but that the store is doing a unit volume that's higher than the average. I don't like these low sales stores. Those are the ones that get closed. So those are things I look out for. Deferred maintenance is not always a throw the deal in garbage, but it's definitely we're going to make you pay for that, Mr. or Mrs. Seller, right? So, you know, it all depends on the situation.
We have a somewhat related question that came in. What are the MSA and slash markets in retail that are at high cap rates? And it's probably specific to, you know, the asset class and the like, but let's stick with net lease. 9% plus, are we talking about going in cap rate without changing tenants?
Yeah, and I appreciate that you've framed that as going in cap rate. That's all I'm going to focus on. Because again, if you're going to have an exit cap, it's higher. That's kudos to you. I'm not taking that away from you on the transaction, on the front end. So it's hard to answer because I don't really care about the MSA, okay? Because, you know, the best corner in the worst MSA in the country might be better than the worst corner in the best MSA in the country. So there's so many variables that the MSA to me is almost irrelevant. When I'm underwriting a deal, I'm looking at, like, for example, shopping centers, especially if we're talking at high cap, it's going to be shopping centers. I'm looking at population density. I'm looking at traffic counts on that very road. I'm looking at ingress and egress, right? I'm looking at building age and deferred maintenance. I'm looking at tenant roster and mix. I'm looking at, are the leases diversified rollovers? I don't want all my tenants coming due, their leases expiring in the same year, because I could have 100% vacancy, right? Those are the types of things that I'm looking at. I'm looking at population growth versus population decline. So that everything I just, oh, I'm sorry, there's a few more. I'm looking at proximity to major national retailers. If there's national retailers in the area, that's a good thing. If Walmart felt like it was a good idea to be within a half a mile of this property, that tells me they did their homework. If McDonald's is on the other corner, that tells me it's good real estate. So those are all variables that I can transpose over any MSA in the country. I can find that in any MSA in the country. So unfortunately, I'm not going to answer your question, but I am answering your question because I'm telling you from my perspective, the MSA doesn't matter. The fundamentals matter. In addition to that, the lease guarantor matters. The rent to sales ratio matters. Everything we discussed previously matters. But what I will tell you is that there's plenty of shopping centers for 9+ caps in MSAs all over the country. You just need to link up with a broker like me who will help you find those. And there are, keep in mind, deals that fit those parameters that I just described that are 9-cap deals. Some are better than others. Why? Now I am going to get into your upside, right? MSA, by the way, is a metropolitan statistical area. I live in Michigan. I live in Birmingham, Michigan, but that's part of the Detroit MSA, the Detroit Metropolitan Statistical Area. So think about it. Normally it's a big city or, you know, in cases of like Minneapolis, St. Paul, Twin Cities, or maybe even three cities together and the surrounding areas, right? You typically have to look at a map, see where the MSA, the Metropolitan Statistical Area, ends. So that's a great question. Back to what you were asking about the 9-cap is, now I am going to dig into your plan, not just going in cap rate. Yeah, I'll find you a bunch of 9-cap deals, but I want to find you the 9-cap deal that's going to have you the highest exit cap rate if we do A, B, C, X, Y, Z to force appreciation at that property.
How long have you lived in Birmingham?
I've lived in Birmingham. Well, that was the house I was referring to before, about 2.5 years.
Oh, gosh. And before that?
Before that, I lived most recently in Oak Park.
Okay. I actually, summer of 2019 to summer 2021, lived in Auburn Hills for a year and then lived in Royal Oak. And Royal Oak after that. So, yeah,
Royal Oak, as you know, is just down the road from me. Yeah. I actually went to college at Oakland University, which is like Auburn Hills, Rochester Hills area.
Oh, that's where, yeah, that's where I stayed. Like, I got in at student housing. I was trying to save money. And so for some reason, they let people who weren't students stay there. And I figured, hey, if I'm going to graduate out of college, I could still live around people my age. So I lived at Oakland University, like student housing for a year.
Nice. I lived across the street at Beacon Hill apartment complex.
Okay.
So I know that. Yeah, that's great. Small world.
Yeah. And then Birmingham's really nice. When I started out, I was a realtor. So my brokerage was in Birmingham, the Remax that I was at.
Oh, yeah. Which one?
Yeah. Nexus.
What? Say again?
Remax Nexus.
Oh, okay. I don't know where that one is.
Yeah. It's in Birmingham. The broker, his name's Ron Rose.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Small world, though.
It is, for sure, no doubt. Yeah. We have some more questions, it looks like.
Yeah, and a follow-up question, what are the pathways to force appreciation? You said something about not swinging a hammer and still growing the principal. Can you elaborate?
Yeah, so there's really three major ways in net lease to force appreciation. Okay, the first one is, we could call it like the vacant repositioning. Very simple. You buy a vacant Burger King, you get Starbucks to sign a lease with you. You give them X amount of dollars to do tenant improvements. They get into the property. Now you've got, oh, I'm just making up numbers. You bought this deal for $800,000. They're paying, you know, $150,000 in rent, and it's going to trade at, let's say, a 5.75 cap. $150,000 divided by 5.75 cap, $2,608,000. You might have put $500,000 in tenant improvement dollars that Starbucks then used, but still, you netted over $1 million. So it's active. You're more of a developer, but that's number one. That's pretty simple. I usually do these in a different order, but number two, because we already discussed it, is that shopping center optimization or repositioning. Okay. So you're going to force appreciation by painting the shopping center, by resealing and striping the parking lot, by trimming, you know, doing new landscaping, by putting up a new pylon sign, by evicting the tenant that's not paying, by increasing your occupancy, filling the center up, by putting better tenants in there. You're also going to do it by, I've said this at least two or three times so far today, converting gross leases to triple net leases for two reasons. Number one, if you have a gross lease, you have to pay the expenses as the owner, and those expenses can be variable, right? Taxes go up, the cost of snow plowing goes up. That's on you, right? If you convert those to triple net leases, you put those back on the tenant, you're now going to increase your NOI, number one. And number two, you're actually going to lower your cap rate, because investors would rather buy a triple net leased shopping center than a shopping center with gross leases, okay? So what you're doing now is you're going to increase your NOI through everything I just mentioned. You're also, by the way, when the tenants are rolling over, and rolling over means when the tenants' leases are expiring, you're going to tell them, hey, Mr. and Mrs. Tenant, I know you've been paying $11 a foot for the last 30 years, but the market is 17 bucks a foot. You're at 17, because there's so many centers all across the country that I call like mom and pop centers, where they're owned by mom and pop investors who just said, you know, I don't care. This property is bringing me in 150 grand a year. It's paying for my kids' education, paying for my vacations. I don't need to ask for rental increases. And now they have artificially low rents. Well, that's an opportunity for you to force appreciation. So again, remember we talked, there's only two factors that determine value in commercial real estate. That's cap rate and NOI, right? So your cap rate, you've enhanced your cap rate and lowered it by beautifying your center, by putting better tenants in there that are more stable, right? And by doing things like converting from gross to triple net. Now, NOI, you increase by raising rents, by going to triple net leases, by, you know, getting rid of tenants that were not paying and putting in better tenants and filling the vacancy. So those two factors work in tandem to really increase your value. That's the second strategy, okay? Now, I know you alluded to what I said before, and I was hoping somebody would catch this, was ways of forcing appreciation without swinging hammer, right? So I'm the guy that was telling the guys to swing the hammer, and I'm the one that'll tell you that that gets really old really quick. When people would ask me what I did for a living, I would tell them half jokingly that I was in adult daycare, because that's exactly what I was doing. I was babysitting contractors, right? So you don't want to do that. You want to force appreciation without swinging the hammer. I can pretty much guarantee everyone on this call has never heard of what I'm about to describe. And I think it's mind-blowing. It's what's called the blend and extend, okay? I'm going to give you most things. I just give examples. So I had a client, He had a Walgreens in Ohio, and he built the Walgreens. In fact, he built the whole center. He was a developer about 22 and a half years ago. So 22 and a half years ago. It was a 25-year lease. And when the deal got to me, there were 14 months left on the lease. He said, Dan, sell the deal for me. And I said, I'm not selling this deal for you. He's like, what are you talking about? I said, we're going to do a blend and extend. He's like, what the hell is a blend and extend? I said, I'll help you. Don't you worry. Okay. So this deal, Walgreens, it was like a mid to low rent Walgreens. They weren't paying a ton. They were paying on this site, they were paying $285 a year, $285,000 a year. I'm sorry, $290,000 a year. Now, this was a few years ago, so the cap rates that I'm going to use, they're not representative of today's cap rates. However, the principle is still the same. So $290,000, high-risk deal. Why is it a high-risk deal? Walgreens has 14 months on their lease. What if they leave, right? Their sales were like average. So if they leave, you're left with a vacant building that's worth $1 million, which is nothing compared to what it's worth now. So high-risk deal, high return, 9 cap, okay? So 9 cap, $3,222,000. Again, $290,000 rent, 9% cap, $3,222,000. Remember that, $3,222,000. So I said, client, go do a blend and extend. Go to Walgreens, ask them for a new 10-year lease. He's like, okay, sounds good. I said, but they're going to come back to you and they're going to say, we might do this 10-year lease. We want a rent reduction. He just kind of like gave me an eyebrow lift over the phone. So anyway, client goes to Walgreens, says, I want a 10-year lease. Walgreens says, no problem. We'll give you a 10-year lease, but we got to reduce the rent from $290,000, okay? And we're going to reduce it all the way down to $230,000. So you might ask, why in the world would anybody be willing to forego $60,000 of annual income? It sounds crazy a little bit, doesn't it? A little crazy. So I'll tell you, because at the time, a Walgreens with 10 years on it was trading at a 5.85 cap. So let's go down to $230,000 and do the math. $230,000 at a 5.85 is $3,931,000. Subtract the $3,222,000 that it was worth previously. That's, I don't know if it's backwards. Yeah. $709,000 and change from what? What did they renovate? They renovated the lease. They did a blend and extend. They blended the rent. They lowered it and they extended the lease. Yeah, the guy's losing $60,000 a year right off the bat. But if he's going to sell it, don't you think he wants that $709,000 of forced appreciation without swinging a single hammer?
Nice. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. So I think, go ahead. I see the questions too, so I'm getting excited by them. I don't know if you want to read them or you want me to.
So the next question, curious how you view percentage rents in retail. Is it becoming popular or not? Do you think it's worth pursuing that versus triple net?
So now, I think what you mean is a percentage rent lease. You don't mean like the percentage of rent to sales like I talked about before. That must be what you mean. If not, just, drop the comment. But I'll explain first what a percentage rent lease is. So normally in like a single tenant triple net deal, the base rent is spelled out in the lease. That's what you collect. Okay. Very simple, straightforward. A percentage rent lease can be written in many different ways, and some of them are so darn, confusing. It's crazy. But typically you'll have, so let's just say as an example, normal Wendy's property, $125,000 is like a decent average low base rent. So that might be one deal. That's what you collect, $125,000. Another deal might have percentage rent that says, for example, I'm just making this up, but you get a base rent of $100,000, and then you get 2.5% of all sales over $1 million. So if that year they do $2 million and you get 2.5% of that, what is that? That's $25,000. You got your base $100,000. $100,000 plus $25,000, that equals $125,000. So it works out to be the same. But what if the next year they only do $1 million in sales? Now you're down to $112,500. And that's, by the way, I made an extreme example. Normally it's like, you know, you get a base rent of $70,000 plus 8.5% of sales, or it could just be a straight percentage rent lease that says you get 8.5% of sales. Sometimes it'll say 8.5% of sales with a floor. Sometimes it'll say with a ceiling. Can be very complicated. Bottom line is, I don't like them, okay? And the reason I don't like them is the same exact reason I don't like multifamily. And it's the same exact reason I don't like gross leases in a shopping center. Why? You could probably guess, I don't like variability in my investment, especially when that variability can hurt me, okay? I've seen percentage rent deals where I price them out for my client 1 year, and the next year they're worth hundreds of thousands of dollars less. And I got no choice because I can only work with the income that's there. And by the way, investors don't like them because they don't like the variability. So guess what happens? The cap rate goes up even more. So that's why I don't like percentage rent leases at all. As a landlord, I would probably never agree with one unless it was written incredibly in my favor, right? And as an investor, I wouldn't buy one. As a broker, I hate when I'm looking at one because I don't like the fact that my client's not going to get as much money for it. I would, you know, 8 days a week take an absolute triple net lease that has base rent over a percentage rent lease, unless it was like the base rent lease said 125 and the percentage rent lease said 120 plus 10% of sales. You see what I'm saying? With the exception of those outliers, which don't ever occur, nope, not for me. That's one I would throw in the garbage in reference to what you guys asked earlier.
Okay, well, we have 5 minutes here, so we're gonna ask some of our wrapping up questions. First off, when you got started in the net lease space, Dan, what was one of the biggest fallacies or falsehoods that you had to, you know, get through, and just to give our listeners something to keep an eye out for?
You know, you lived in Metro Detroit, right? And yeah. You lived in Metro Detroit at a time when Detroit was really coming out of its, you know, funk, the city of Detroit, that is. But, you know, when I was flipping houses in Detroit and setting up rentals for people, you know, when I was looking at cap rate, you know what a cap rate was that, like, I was like, okay, that's cool, I'm kind of excited about? It's probably like 35%, okay? So, you know, 35% return on investment. Get your whole investment back in less than three years. So when I got into net lease brokerage and I was like, a 5 cap Taco Bell? Like, I don't get it, right? So I didn't get it. But once I got into it, I started getting it, which was, you know, people want to preserve their wealth. People want stability. They want security. You know, people want to have things be absolute and relatively guaranteed. And they're okay with that lower return in exchange for pretty much no risk and 100% passivity, right? That 35% return in Detroit, maybe it's burned down today. I don't know. You know, maybe somebody stole all the copper plumbing, right? A lot of risk that comes with that. So I would say that was a you know, something that to me was murky and misunderstood. But when I got into it, I understood that it made sense to me. And further, there's a whole other world that we haven't even discussed, which is like the banking and lending world. And the fact is like, you know, you have money that's being sourced at incredibly low rates. And I'm talking about like life insurance money, right? And you have all of this capital that is then deployed on the AAA banner best net lease assets in the country that are spitting off a return of 4.5%, 5%, 6%. But that's still a huge, that's where those funds want to invest their money because that's a great investment for them. So it's like, once you understand the ecosystem of commercial real estate, you understand why there's different tranches of, you know, cap rates for different assets.
35% cap rate's wild, but it is Detroit. Yeah. So
exactly.
And how do you give back to your community, Dan?
I mean, one of the ways is just to make myself available. You know, I probably once a week have a call with someone. I mentioned a call earlier on our webinar that I had, you know, where essentially like people reach out to me. They want advice on brokerage. They are getting into brokerage, or they're having a hard time in brokerage, or they're doing a transition into brokerage, or they're getting into investments, or they just want, you know, an extra set of eyes on a deal. So I try to make myself available as much as I can to help people and to give back that way. I mean, it's rewarding to me, and I love having people come back 6 months later saying, Dan, we had this conversation, this is what I've done, and like life is amazing. So that's probably, I'd say, that the primary way that I like to give back.
And lastly, what's the best way to reach out to you for folks who have more questions?
So first of all, you know, like I'm very active on LinkedIn. I put out content daily. So you can definitely follow there, reach out, connect, send a message, tell me, you know, that how we got connected. My first name is Dan. Last name is Lukowicz, LewKowicz. Again, LewKowicz. Please reach out that way. I hope that you find value in the content that I produce. I put a lot of thought into that. Additionally, if anybody wants to reach out, if anybody has a property they want to sell, or they want to know what it's worth, or, you know, they just want to talk, like I mentioned, they want to talk shop and real estate, or they need help with the transition or advice, you know, I'll give you guys my direct cell phone number. It's 248-943-2838. Again, 248-943-2838. And if there's anything I can do to add value, it would be my pleasure.
Gotcha. Well, thank you again, Dan, for taking the time to come join us.
My pleasure.
Educate us.
Absolutely.
About net leases. And for those of you listening at home, this episode will be uploaded to YouTube and all the major Spotify, other podcasting platforms. We'll include Dan's contact information as well. And until next time, keep learning and investing for generational wealth.